everybody, to a very special episode of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry. Yes, it is time. Unsolved Mysteries, part whatever. I don't know. Maybe 7, 8. I don't know. With me, my guest, the very spooky Barry Rose. Barry, how are you doing today?
Good. So I'm a guest now. I've been relegated to guest.
Okay, so you're the fucking co-host. I messed
okay,
up.
Thank go you. Ahead. There we go.
You're like McAdam. You're a very special guest.
Yes, exactly. My special guest this week, right?
Well, given the creepy voice, you didn't pick up on that. I expected you to go, hello, this is guest Barry Rose. You know, but you didn't do it.
I was thrown off by guest.
What sort of vocal talent are you, Barry? Come on. Work with
zero. Zero vocal talent, actually. Yes. But Jeff, very excited for this one because how long has it been? So with that, I think our friend Adam Domau, and I believe I'm pronouncing his name correctly, has said that we have done 5 Unsolved Mystery. So this is the guy I think that we need.
Well, but he's only up to episode 99, I think. And yeah. I think I want to say the last one we did was somewhere in the vicinity of 105.
Okay. And that makes sense because he said we've done 5 previously, but Adam is the guy we need to catalog our shows for. So
yes, we once, I think, asked a certain John Doe, and he didn't take care of business. I don't know if I asked or not, but I thought I had. But if Adam is willing to do that, we will give him a shout out on the show, and we promise to pronounce his name correctly. Folks, it is time for Unsolved Mysteries, which, by the way, let me very quickly add that for those of you with Netflix, Unsolved Mysteries Part 2 on Netflix, I believe debuting the day we're recording this, which is Monday. So maybe give that a check out. I'm planning on doing that, depending on how good or bad the football game is tonight. So, Barry. Oh, and before we get into the Unsolved Mysteries, one final thing. Barry, how'd you like the license plate, by the way?
Oh, boy, did I love the license plate. So that was that. And you're right. You completely kayfabed me on that one. I had no idea.
I tell you, yes.
That's dead. Let me ask you a question. Is there any other podcast out there? Jeff, you and I talked off air today about a lot of things. Is there any other podcast out there currently that you're aware of that has a customized license plate?
No.
Exactly.
No.
Exactly.
Ryan Last. No. Does McAdam have one that says stick to wrestling? No.
No.
You know, and the Mid-Atlantic guys, the Mid-South guy. No, they don't have fucking customized license plate. I put my fucking money into this show in the form of a customized license plate. Do I get recompensated by the great Brian Last? Probably not. But anyway, let's get on to the fact is you like the license plate. Thank you very much. It was a nice surprise for the group, and I had a lot of fun doing that. My first choice was Chigusa. I think that was taken by somebody. Stephen Prazak or one of those guys took my Chigusa idea for the license plate. I'm just kidding. Now let's go Unsolved Mysteries. Barry, would you like to go first or would you like me to go first?
Sir, your name comes first. I will let you make that decision.
That's right. You're the guest on this fucking show.
I'm just a guest. I will let you want.
Let me just, for the audience, for those of you who have not listened to one of our Unsolved Mysteries episodes, and if you haven't, why not? What we do here is Barry and I each take a look at 3 different unsolved mysteries. They can be murders. They can be disappearances, this sort of things. We tried the paranormal once. Barry didn't like that too much. So we're not doing any paranormal stuff anymore because, quite frankly, Barry doesn't believe in that. So Barry and I have each gone I will completely and fully say that I go on a YouTube and do a deep dive and start looking for stuff that, kind of holds my interest or sparks my interest. And as we said right before, I was doing a little bit of research on Barry's stories, and I found another story that completely I would have definitely used on this show if I had known about it before 10 minutes before we started recording. I'll be talking about that because I think that might be when we do Unsolved Mysteries Part 7 or 8 or whatever it is. I think a story that needs to be looked at because it involves a murder and a shoddy investigation and a conviction that perhaps was not deserved, but that's another story for another time. The first story that I'm going to talk about, Lord Barons, is the disappearance of a young lady named Claudia Lawrence. So first off, right off the top of your head, did you ever hear this story?
No, just based off the name, I've never heard it.
Okay, well, Claudia Lawrence, and I will give full credit. I saw her name pop up on a Watch Mojo video on YouTube. And the first thing that struck me was she facially looks similar to a friend of mine who lives in Arizona. Shout out to my friend Kenda, who I know who has never, ever listened to this podcast, but I'll give her a shout out anyway. So Claudia Lawrence, a young woman in her mid-30s, Barry, who worked as a chef at the local university. She lived in York, England, which is, I want to say, about the same distance from London town as you would find Fort Lauderdale to Orlando.
All right.
Okay. So she lived in York, England, disappeared on March 18th, 2009. She was very well liked in her job. She had studied hard, for her work as a chef, really enjoyed it. So she's last seen one day walking to work. And the next day, she's not answering her phone. Now, this is very unusual, according to all the people that were talked to. They said she was seemingly a very reliable girl, had a steady job, and it just seemed very out of the ordinary. So on the second day, when she still hadn't been heard of, her dad and some friends from work enter her home. And which she bought herself. She had lived with her parents for quite a while, but she, because her job was very, good job. She had good money coming in. She bought her own home. The kind of weird thing was that absolutely nothing was out of place. Her purse was there. Her phone was there. Her passport was there. So, anyone who suspected, well, maybe she skipped town or something like that, her passport was sitting right by her purse. So that makes it even more mystifying. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. Her phone was not there. The only two things missing from her home were her phone and her backpack that she usually brought with her to work. So it seemed as though to the initial glance that she got up, got ready for work, and then vanished. She had about a 45-minute walk to work because I believe her car was being worked on. And so she just decided to walk to work one morning. So her story becomes a front page sensation where she lives, because she seemingly has disappeared. They're asking people if you have any kind of information. Nobody knows anything. So they start looking at the closed circuit TVs, which, of course, now every street out there, Barry, has some sort of camera affixed to it. And by God, this is 2009. And even in 2009 in this town, they had the closed circuit TVs. And so they pick her up walking to work in the morning. And that was the last time anyone had seen her. Let's see here. Her phone apparently had been turned off, quote unquote, manually at a little after midnight the night before. A cyclist who was out that morning observed her talking to what police described as a man who smoked with his left hand. So he became known as the left-handed smoker that police wanted to speak with.
The left-handed smoker.
The left-handed. That sounds very, very Dashiell Hammett. The left-handed smoking.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, a Dashiell Hammett reference there, Barry.
Wow.
That's sure about by the way, 6% of our audience understand that.
And I was corrected multiple times. Dylan Thomas was not British. He was Welsh.
I saw that. How can you fucking say he's Irish? I saw that.
Exactly.
So a cyclist who's out, doing his bicycling, observes a woman talking to this man who has a cigarette in his left hand. They're chatting and goes on. So the police continue to investigate. Nothing's turning up. Again, she appears to have vanished in thin air. They're going back in. They're checking her house, combing it for all kind of, details, large and small. Can't find anything. The family, I will say, is very unhappy. They're not pleased with the way the police are proceeding with the investigation. The police finally release a video of a man seen at around 5 o'clock in the morning, the morning after her disappearance, kind of walking around, going around her back, towards her back of her house, down the alley of her house. The police asked the man to come forward because, the presumption is maybe it was just some guy that lived in the neighborhood. And, he would come forward and say, "Oh, I was going over to a friend's house to pick him up that morning," or, whatever. But no one ever came forward claiming to be the man. Another video that was released, also presumably of the same guy, came forward that was the night before she was murdered, walking through the neighborhood. And there's a very interesting scene where you see someone walking sort of like where they're getting ready to crisscross. And the man in question stops, lets the other person pass, sort of like he didn't want to be seen, Barry.
Oh,
Yeah, that's pretty good, huh? And then he proceeds on after the person has continued walking. So now the police have this little bit of information about Claudia. Remember, Barry, before we started recording, I told you there was a twist to this story.
Yeah.
Here it comes. Get ready for the twist. So now we've heard about Claudia, you know, hardworking chef at the local university, you know, loves her parents and, you know, that kind of thing. Matter of fact, last phone call she had made was to both her parents who were divorced about arranging to get together with them, you know, at some point. I believe it was Mother's Day coming up when she disappeared and she wanted to get up with, you know, meet up with her mom for dinner or something. And then the next night she wanted to speak to her dad. She had remained close to both her parents, I believe, but the parents had separated, were not talking, you know, didn't have any contact with one another, but she had maintained a good relationship with both of them. So then the police, after this investigation they had done, make a decision that the family, needless to say, was not real happy with. So here's the police, Barry. They're caught in the proverbial quandary. So if you have this person who has disappeared, now by this point, when what I'm about to say comes forward, it had been a couple months. You have a lot of sympathy going out for this woman who seemingly has disappeared off the face of the earth. I mean, it was like, you know, when I say that, no body was found. There was no signs of a struggle in her house, which, you know, was seemed relatively odd. So it's almost as if she had seen somebody that she knew that perhaps had picked her up, because there's no, you know, no signs of a struggle, no, you know, missing, you know, like you find something on the sidewalk where she was last seen, you know, like right. There'd been a struggle or something like that. So then the police sort of release their hidden information that they didn't want to, because it sort of turned the public's perception on Claudia, because apparently, Barry, Claudia had a secret life.
Oh, yeah.
So apparently, Claudia liked married men. Oh, my.
How old was Claudia? What was the age on Claudia?
35.
Okay, it's a little older, but still okay. Okay.
She's still an acceptable age there. Don't be being prejudiced there, Barry.
No. Absolutely.
So she apparently had a thing for married men, and there was a claim that she had up to, get a load of this. This is even beyond Barry Rose territory, that she had 40 mystery lovers.
Oh, my.
So, yeah. You know, and that's even more than you, as I said, Barry. Now the question comes, first of all, now all of a sudden the public's perception goes from being, oh, this poor girl, you know, the girl next door. Now it's like, that filthy tramp. Is that an Irish accent or British? I'm not sure. Anyway.
It's Welsh.
Yeah. It's like that Dylan Thomas.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to ever let you forget that one. And so now the perception of the public has changed to now from this neighborhood girl. So now this local tart has been abducted. But now the police start focusing on whether or not jealousy or, you know, some sort of revenge might have taken place here. You know, maybe this was something where this was a jealous lover or a married man who doesn't want the wife to find out about it. Sure. You know, so maybe something like that happened. And also now the question comes up in the police, you know, in their investigation, they start wondering if maybe the reason why some people that are friends of hers aren't being quite as forthcoming as we would like is that, well, maybe they have a little something to hide. You know, maybe that man that might have seen something doesn't want his wife to know that he knows Claudia. So that's something that the police is concerned about. But of course, the family is, of course, outraged that now their daughter has been made out to be, you know, the town local hussy. Which I believe that's the first time we've ever used the word hussy.
That's
here.
It's a good
on
word,
show.
Too. I think good that's word. Actually from the UK she's also.
She's a local hussy, that one. Now, that was, by the way. And so the investigation continues. Nothing comes up. Okay. 2014, a man is arrested for the murder and another man is arrested. I love this charge, by the way, Barry. Perverting of justice. that could be a wide range of possibilities there. But both are eventually released, not charged. Later on, there were a couple of more men that were arrested, but they ended up having to drop all charges because they, you know, they basically didn't have enough evidence to hold them. So now we take our third twist. Actually, second twist of the story.
Second twist.
now a name emerges that apparently in England is quite well known, and that is a gentleman named Christopher Halliwell. Christopher Halliwell is a convicted serial killer. Now, you know what makes a serial killer, which raises eyebrows as far as serial killers goes, Barry, is when you're being interviewed in prison and you ask the local authorities this question. How many people would I have to kill to be considered a serial killer?
There you go. What are the qualifications?
That's the kind of thing that perhaps raises a question. I don't know. Maybe I in like my that. Mind, not yours. Who knows? But anyway, so they start looking at this guy, Christopher Halliwell, who apparently is, though he lives a couple hundred miles away, his father, lives down the street from old Claudia there. And so they start investigating. Oh, and by the way, Barry, Christopher Halliwell, left-handed, known smoker. Oh, yes.
Oh. Yes. Boom.
Boom goes the dynamite, as they say. And so now they start focusing on Christopher Halliwell. And a witness is claimed to have seen. I just realized in my notes that I wrote claim to have seen, and I spelled seen S-C-E-N-E. So, I'm not really good at spelling. But anyway, and then they claim to have seen the two of them speaking together, okay? So maybe it was a case of, you know, Christopher offered her a ride to work because she had about a 45-minute walk to work, which, that's as Maureen O'Hara once said in the movie The Quiet Man, that's a good stretch of the legs. And so I'm making a reference to a movie that's it's like 70 years old here. And so the parents were also critical that the fact that the police budget only allowed them to offer £40,000 for the information leading to the arrest of the killer, which nowadays would be worth about $50,000 American money. I got to say, 50 grand American money, that's not a bad haul. I don't know what 40,000 was worth at the time the police offered this. But again, the police believed they'd been lied to during the investigation by Claudia's friends. Again, perhaps somebody who had been having some sort of illicit romance with Claudia. And also the original photo that the police released, you know, you always see a missing person, this person missing. Apparently the photo they released was her as a blonde when her mom said, like 2 weeks before she was gone missing, her mom had gone out with her and her hair was brunette. She had changed her hair color. And so her mom started talking, that's not what she looks like, which certainly could hamper potentially an investigation if the photo in question looks nothing like the person that they're looking for, Barry. So anyway, as I started looking into this case, I'm kind of have a suspicion, and needless to say, there's been absolutely 11 years now plus since this woman disappeared, not one single piece of evidence involving her, physical evidence has come up to where, you know, oh, they suddenly found her watch or something like that, or something, or they discovered a skull in a field, and nothing has ever come. So I'm thinking this Christopher Halliwell, because he was arrested a couple years afterwards, and you know he was a man who committed two really horrible murders. One woman, all they found left of her was her skull, and it's kind of horrific. And so he was a guy that was really one of those guys who police first identified him as a potential serial killer because of the sort of the lifeless gaze in his eyes, you know, the faraway look they talk about. And so I'm guessing that unfortunately Claudia might have run into this Christopher Halliwell. That's complete speculation on my part. So what do you think, Barry?
I think so. I mean, we'll backtrack a little bit. She's a reasonably attractive 35-year-old who can also cook. This makes her a prime catch. She's willing to have carnal relations with married men.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, again, this makes her a huge catch, but you're looking at suspects. So she's got 40 lovers. Then there's assumption there's 40 spouses. So that's 80 suspects right there. Could have been a child. And when I say child, an older child of one of the adults. So the suspect pool is absolutely huge. Certainly left-handed smoker, has a history. He's got this thing with skulls, likes to kill. He becomes the prime
that's
suspect.
That's a key.
Yeah, that's absolutely key right there. But they I don't think I missed this. Correct me if I'm wrong. They never found the body, correct?
Never. Nothing has ever. You know,
is that corpus delecti? Is that right?
That is very impressive. A little Latin on Mr. Rose's part. That's not the pig Latin either.
lot of fucking Law and Order, my friend. Let me tell you.
Exactly. Right. I have just texted you a photo of said Claudia Lawrence.
All right, hold on. Hold on. Going to pull this up.
You're going to pull what?
Hey, now. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. So there's she's attractive. So, yeah, that's I'm going to read this article, actually, when we're done. She's actually attractive. Is that her father that's holding the photo?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. And we got to say, too, it's only I can't see the photo great, but she looks extremely physically fit also. So, that's a real shame right there. They, 11 years later, you know, God knows where the body is. But at this point, I know that you can charge somebody with murder, even if there's not a body. My guess is they're feeling that the evidence for this Halliwell guy isn't it circumstantial or it's not deep enough?
Well, you know, the amazing thing about him is he's doing life without the possibility of parole for the two murders.
Got it.
And so, you know, it's not like they can do anything worse to him because apparently, sure. I don't know, I guess they don't have a death penalty, at least in his cases. And it's just like, you know, oh, yeah, by the way, I did this other one. You know, give the family some relief, at least like, you know, let them know. Yeah, I was the one that killed her. I'm not getting out of prison anytime soon. Hell, I chopped one chick's head off. So, you know, what more can they do to me? So, yeah, I killed her. You know, well, it's just, you know.
Yeah, but watching all the Law and Order episodes to reference, which the only thing I know about the law, essentially, but they can offer him a certain deal in the sense that without taking off time, but maybe give him a better cell. Maybe he gets more free time out in the yard to get shanked. Who knows?
They offered it to Hannibal Lecter, my friend.
See? See, you know? Exactly. So, yeah, you would think that something could be done.
The beach, the private beach on our private island where, you know, he would
that's
be
right.
Haunted, you know, and
so
it was all a big fabrication. So we will
that's
post a link.
Story.
Yeah, yeah. A link to this story, Claudia Lawrence in York, England. So Barry,
I love the stories, too, that have these sordid twists, especially if they involve sex. But speaking of that, Jeff, and with that segue, because I was going to do it.
You are the king of segues, my friend.
Let me ask you a question, Jeff.
Please.
What do Warren Beatty, Mick Jagger, Joe Namath, DJ Frankie Crocker?
Well, of course, the legendary DJ Frankie Crocker.
Of course. A couple of Buffalo Bills players and the Shah of Iran.
Not Jim Kelly, I hope, because he had that experience.
So I'm going to butcher allegedly. His last name.
Allegedly with a certain former wrestling ballet.
That's right. I remember hearing that. But this guy, the one that I could verify, Ray Bruzacy. I'm sure I'm killing that last name. Something hardcore Italian. It's Abruzzese something. Okay. But apparently all these people I just mentioned, as well as several hundred other men and women have in common. They all had carnal relations with Hollywood starlet Krista Helm. So Krista Helm was this tall, blonde, gorgeous, I'll put quote unquote actress. Because let's be honest, that I think the acting really, I think she was attractive.
She did a lot of acting, but maybe not on the screen.
And you know, if you're going Krista Helm, that sounds familiar. Yeah, she was born a completely different name, like a Sandro something. You know, she wasn't an actress per se, but she was really hot. She did have bit parts on the Wonder Woman show with Linda Carter, Starsky and Hutch. And she was often referred to, Jeff, as the Black Dahlia of the disco era. So before I get into the fact that she was brutally murdered, and we'll talk about that, let's discuss a little bit of her early life, because I think it plays into who she was. She was a definite wild child. She became pregnant, married at 16 years old, gave birth at 17, and her husband left her shortly after. I think he was a couple of years older.
Men are pigs, let's be honest.
And let's be honest, especially if you're like a 17 or 18 year old. I don't know how old the husband was, but I know he was young as well. She left her daughter with a nanny in Vermont. She left her home state. She traveled to New York City in pursuit of a modeling and acting career. She had very minor success in New York. And then she moved to Los Angeles, realizing what her future was. She met a big time financier. And, you know, whenever they put the word or it's two words, big time in front of financier, you know, this guy's a roller of the highest stakes. His name was Bernie Kornfeld.
I'm guessing Bernie wanted a Kornfelder.
Pretty much. If
we're essentially 12 years old here, folks. Okay, go ahead.
We really are. But if you're like 20 years old and you're dating a guy like in his 50s named Bernie Kornfeld, yeah, we kind of know what's going on at this point. Anyways, she moved to L.A. She moves in with Bernie Kornfeld. Bernie Kornfeld, again, big time financier, 39 room mansion in Los Angeles. So This guy was a big time deal. He absolutely, the house was housing numerous people from up and coming actors and actresses to a lot of lackeys and flunkies that Bernie had. It was a nonstop party. There were parties going on day and night. These were sexual in nature, drug fueled, allegedly. But Krista fit right in with that. Krista in later years was described by her daughter as a free agent who openly enjoyed sex. So, you know, she had priorities. I respect that. I got no problem with that. But the acting really wasn't going too well. Again, bit parts on...
Was she an acting free agent or a sexual free agent?
I think she was a sexual free agent. And that's really...
The first time we've ever used those three words together.
That's a hell of
We should title this episode Sexual Free Agent. I like that. That's good.
It really is good, too.
And also, it'll bring in... let's be honest. You look at that. Check through the podcast scroll here. Sexual free agent. Fuck yeah. I'm listening to this one. Okay.
Jeff, going back to my youth, two words that apparently every broadcaster, every news agency reiterated: sex sells.
Yes.
So yes, do what you got to do. But so at this point, Starsky and Hutch, Wonder Woman, she had a small part in a movie as well. I forget what the movie's name was, but nobody ever saw this movie. She decided that the acting, maybe I'll try something new. What did she do? Disco career. She signed on to Casablanca Records, and they brought in DJ Frankie Crocker, who I referenced earlier. Now, Frankie Crocker was a guy that I never knew up until probably the early 80s, maybe the mid 80s. He was a DJ. I take it back. He was a VJ on VH1. And he was African-American. He had a delivery somewhere along the lines of Barry White. Like this guy was, he would get deep down. Exactly. Yeah, he was the real deal, but he was an up and coming producer at this point. He had been a DJ. He had gotten in trouble for payola not too long after this. So he had a pretty varied career. On a trivia note, he wound up dying 10, 20 years ago in North Miami, Florida, which you and I both know, of pancreatic cancer. God rest his soul. But as it turns out, these two didn't get along. The relationship fizzled out. And Krista, one thing about her as well, and this is a common denominator with her stories, she liked to talk. She would tell people things that maybe she shouldn't have told people. I sometimes get the impression that besides being a sexual free agent, Jeff, she wasn't overly bright. And I believe there was a lack of education with this. But she did tell somebody that when she separated from Crocker, that it was all her idea because she, quote unquote, had him by the balls. At this time, Krista started to party really hard, got mixed up in a really crowd that was hardcore into cocaine and other drugs. And she would later tell a friend that she was kind of afraid of the people that she was associating with her sexual free agency. Besides all these other names I've mentioned, she decided that she was going to enter into relationships with women. So the lesbianism of the story.
Now we're talking, baby.
Absolutely. So she began a relationship with not one, but two of her backup singers, a Miss Patty Collins and Debbie Danilo, though there have been conflicting reports about Danilo where she says it was never sexual. With Patty Collins, it definitely was. But here's the big thing about this, Jeff. She slept with a lot of famous people. And I don't know if Bernie Kornfeld, whatever his name was, if he was involved, but she was really making the rounds. However, she kept sex diaries. And
that's bad for those rich people.
It's bad. And in these sex diaries, they had a very detailed rating system for her lovers. So she would rate them on performance, on size, overall experience. These were apparently really, really detailed.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that women? Wait a minute. I just need to clarify this here. women rate men on size? So is that what you're trying to allege?
I'm going to break kayfabe on this one. Women care about size and they want you to have a full head of hair. And that's all I know. So, that's all I know.
Wow. That pretty much killed us.
Killed it all right there. Good thing
I'm sticking with my wife.
You stick with your wife and I'm in the twilight of my life. So I'm like, you know what? If this had happened when I was 20, I'd be really fucked. But at this stage, I'm fine. But any case, besides the fact that that Krista was keeping these really detailed sex diaries, she was also secretly recording many of these sessions on audio tape. So she had it, and she told people that she was doing this because at one day, one stage of her career or lack thereof, she was going to write a book about all of her adventures in Hollywood. However, according to those who were close to her, that was bullshit. She was keeping it because she wanted to blackmail the Hollywood bigwigs. She had all the dirt. This is kind of an Epstein deal right here in some ways.
That little tart.
Yes. However, things went horribly wrong on the night of February 12, 1977. Krista went to a Hollywood party with her roommate, who was named Stephanie. Very attractive, by the way. Krista left the party to go to the home of her friend and agent, Sandy Smith. And when I say agent, I put that in quotation marks because he was kind of a very sketchy, slimy character. I guess a lot of agents are. However, when Krista arrived at Sandy's house, she was brutally stabbed some 30 times and beaten with a blunt force object on the street in front of the house, left for dead with no eyewitnesses.
Nobody saw nothing.
Nobody saw. And this is Los Angeles, first off. So this, you know, this wasn't like, you know, the murders of New York where, you know, 30 people heard screams or watched and nobody called the police. Apparently nobody saw anything. So Sandy Smith is inside the house. This is taking place literally in the street in front of his house. He denies hearing anything that night. Never saw Krista, didn't hear a word, claims he's sleeping. Her body, however, yeah. Her body was discovered by a young man who was crossing the street. According to some reports, he found her with the car keys in her hand, partially under the car. However, when investigators arrived on the scene, they took note at the odd way her car had been parked. She allegedly stopped the car abruptly. Her tires were jammed into the curb on the passenger side. This led the officers to believe that someone had been trailing her that evening in West Hollywood. According to reports, Krista then got out of the car, and then neighbors reported hearing people talking loudly. And one neighbor said that he heard, quote, two women and a man. Another ear witness said that they heard vicious screams that sounded like a cat being skinned.
Oh, my.
Now, it's important to note that when Krista's body was found, her purse was missing. And Jeff, guess what was in the purse?
The recordings.
No, well, that we don't know because the tapes of her sexual encounters, which were secretly recorded, have never been found, but the diary was in the purse. And what made that really interesting was that she was known for two things. She never went anywhere without a purse. And the second aspect, that diary was always in the purse. So whoever killed her went for the purse. The last lead in this now cryptic cold case is a postcard that she sent to a friend before she died. I am in way over my head here. I'm into something I can't get out of. That sounds really fucking ominous.
Yeah.
So why don't we look at some of the suspects with this? And Jeff, this is going to be a little interesting to you because you're going to recognize one of these names here. It'll be the third name. So I'll build anticipation with this. The first name is Sandy Smith, who was the alleged talent scout agent. He was Krista's agent and a person whose house Krista was murdered in front of.
Heard nothing.
Exactly. He was didn't hear anything because he had been sleeping all night, right?
Well, exactly.
I have news for you. He was definitely in the Hollywood party scene, potentially had mob ties, and was definitely a shady character. However, his story doesn't add up, Jeff. The young man who discovered Krista on the street was on his way into Sandy's house. So Sandy's saying he's been sleeping and doesn't hear anything. You got a young man coming into your house. Interesting. Sandy had told, you know, investigators he was home alone and in bed all night. Allegedly, witnesses also say they saw people coming and going from the house all night. Krista, according to Stephanie, her roommate, had also been calling Sandy to get him to come to the party. So Sandy, we've already caught him in two or three lies right here. That makes him a suspect in my mind. However, the next suspect is a guy named Rudy Mozella. Rudy was a drug dealer who was also roommates with a guy named Blair Aronson, who was the keyboardist who worked on Krista's disco album. According to various reports, Krista was storing large amounts of cocaine for Mozella, and during that, she stole some of the drugs for him. He found out and got violent. Another crazy thing.
Stealing the cocaine never goes well. No.
Never works out. Another crazy thing, Jeff. Rudy allegedly bragged that he was the one who killed her.
Whoa.
Yes. However, excellent police work here. He wasn't looked at deeply at the time of Krista's murder.
Of course not. Why would he be?
Of course. Why would you if you got a guy bragging about it? But when the case was open in the mid-2000s in the cold case files, Rudy had been dead for years. And there was no way they were going to be able to have a talk to him about this. Did Sandy Smith and Rudy know each other? I mean, Rudy was a drug dealer. Smith was a slimy agent hosting parties in his house.
Sketchy.
Wouldn't be a far stretch. However, the next suspect here is going to be pretty interesting. If I say to you, Paulie Walnuts, Jeff, what do you think of?
Sopranos, right?
Yes, sir. Guy named Tony Sirico. So Tony Sirico, yep, and you heard me right with that, was on The Sopranos. He was a suspect in this case. According to the police reports, the roommate Stephanie said that Tony showed up at their apartment shortly after the party to check on Krista's quote-unquote welfare, but allegedly what he ended up doing was going to their apartment to steal furs and personal documents of Krista's. According to reports, Stephanie believes that it was Tony who stole Krista's tape recordings from her room after the murder.
Allegedly.
This is all alleged. Is he alive or is he dead?
Supposition. I don't know, but I'm making sure. Supposition. Right. Guesswork. Nothing concrete, of course.
All right. I think he may be dead. I don't know why I think that, but I do. The next suspect, this is interesting, too. It's an unnamed movie star. So it's a blind item here. I don't have the name. I can tell you in reading through the lines, supposition, alleged, blah, blah, blah. They're trying to infer that this was Warren Beatty, the actor Warren Beatty, who has a reputation in Hollywood of shagging a lot of women.
Quite the coxman back in his day.
He was a coxman for sure. So the main theory is that someone, one of her high-powered sex partners, found out about her tapes and detailed diary and was not willing to risk that information getting out. Chris, you got to remember, Krista was not shy about telling people about the diary and her ranking system. So if you had something to hide, that would spook you. Why Warren Beatty would want to kill somebody that he's fucked, I don't know. So what happened to the tapes, right? I came across a report where a cold case investigator stated that on the tapes was a recording of a threesome that was described as, quote unquote, a very intense sexual encounter. The threesome was with Patty Collins, who was Krista's backup singer and lesbian lover, Krista, and a well-known movie star. Again, the inference is Warren Beatty. We don't know that for a fact at all. The investigator did not disclose who this person was, but states that he was a man who is still alive and still in the public eye today. When Patty Collins was interviewed, Patty Collins was not happy with Krista at the time of the sexual encounter, and there was a lot of tension between the two. This made it seem like, wait, maybe Patty Collins is now a suspect. So let's look at it this way. Patty Collins, lesbian lover, apparently very possessive. When she found out that Krista might have had a relationship with the other backup singer, Debbie Danilow, apparently went through the roof, threw a fit, was really upset. And then right after the murder of Krista, Patty disappears. can't find her. They're looking for her, nowhere to be found. To this day, they haven't found her. So we don't know. Is she been murdered? Did she pull like the young lady that you talked about earlier? Did somebody kill her and we'll never find the body? They can't find a trace of her. The other backup singer, Debbie Danilo, she knows more than she ever let on. According to the keyboardist, this guy named Blair Aronson, he and Debbie were in a relationship, but he and Krista had sexual relations the night before her murder. Jeff, are you keeping score with who's fucking who in this? Because literally everybody's fucking everybody at this point, right?
They're all so, sexual free agents.
This is the sexual draft of breaking kayfabe right now. So the keyboardist is fucking the backup singer who's in a relationship, but he fucked her. Then I can't keep score who's fucking who at this point. According to the same report, Debbie caught him cheating on her with Krista by watching them have sex through a window. Aronson says this is what happened. Debbie denies it. Okay, so what about DNA evidence? Do we have anything here? When the cold case investigators hopped on the case in 2006, they began testing the DNA under Krista's fingernails from the night she was murdered. She fought for her life, and guess what they turned up? Evidence that shows that it was a woman who she had been fighting with because the skin was underneath her nails. They started searching for all the women in her life. Unfortunately, the only one they could track down was Debbie. They tested Debbie, and no, she wasn't the guilty party. Does make you think that perhaps that Patty was responsible. So looking at all this, was it one of Krista's backup singers? I mean, obviously, Debbie's been ruled out from DNA. Was it the sketchy agent, and sketchy was your word, Sandy Smith, or the drug dealer, Rudy, that bragged that he killed Krista? Maybe it was Tony Sirico. Maybe he was
hired. Still alive, by the way.
Still alive. It definitely wasn't him then. We should clearly say it wasn't him.
100%
he's alive.
Not guilty.
Exactly. But odds are we're never going to know what happened with this story, as a lot of, again, this is 43 years old at this point, and a lot of the participants are dead. But this is a really interesting story to me, and I'll tell you why, because one of the reports that I found said Tony Sirico, and I don't know if he's the killer in this one at all. And odds are, I think it was the drug deal. I think the drug dealer and the agent were somehow connected.
Well, I was going to say, is there a chance that the agent of the sketchy nature perhaps set her up to be,
absolutely. Yeah. That's exactly where I was going to go. There is no way that she shows up at this guy's house, and the second she gets out of the car, she's killed. All they take is her bag. Again, you could say robbery, but the diary's missing. Still to this day, the tapes went missing from the house because she didn't carry the tapes on her. And I think it was the sketchy agent and the drug dealer somehow, because they and it was probably drug related above everything else. What do I know? But the Tony Sirico thing is interesting. And I'll tell you why, because there's a great show on Showtime for years that was canceled called Ray Donovan. And have you ever seen Ray Donovan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw the whole first season.
I fucking love this show. I loved every episode, except for the spoiler, except for where the wife was dying, because it was just brutal. But Tony Sirico apparently was a Ray Donovan type at one point. He was the guy that the studios would call.
The fixer.
Yes, he was the fixer. He was the guy you would call to fix a situation, to beat somebody up, to take something. And allegedly, I had read that Tony Sirico was somehow connected to organized crime in his younger years. So allegedly, right. It's all. But so I do find it interesting that he's involved in this, was considered a suspect. And I do believe, based off of what I read, that he did go to the apartment that night and try to gather as much evidence, because one of the studios probably said, hey, it could have been the Shah of Iran. If you're fucking the Shah of Iran.
Yeah, that was the name you hadn't mentioned yet. And I was going to say, gee, I can't imagine if you're fucking the Shah of Iran, or as the Iron Sheik would say, Iran, and you have audio tapes of it. You've kept copious notes on his length and or girth. And that becomes knowledge to people that were close to the Shah. Yeah, all of a sudden you end up dead. It's not completely out of the realm of speculation, I would
say. No, exactly. It would make perfect sense that, you know, that the military, whatever it was, the his Secret Service, whatever they are, that they decided to take her out one night. What's interesting above all when you look at this is, A, she was stabbed. She wasn't shot. That to me is of some sort of interest. They do believe it was some sort of a buck knife, a military buck knife. But at the same time, the fact that she wasn't shot makes you wonder why she wasn't shot and why she was stabbed. A lot of times they say that when somebody is stabbed, it's more personal, that somebody is more upset and more angry. I don't know. Really interesting case, and one that I kind of fell down, as you like to say, I went down the rabbit hole, and my hour and a half turned into like 4 hours as I discovered more and more shit. So we'll be posting a link to this story in a couple of newspaper articles on Tuesday.
Sexual free agency.
Gotta love it, man.
That's a shame. Yeah. So that's usually what, when you're between marriages, you go through sexual free agency. Nice. All right. So we're going to stay in California for my next story, Barry, except we are going back. Hey, you know, we're nothing if not relevant and topical. So, of course, naturally, my next story goes back to 1928. So, Barry, do you remember one of the very first episodes of Unsolved Mysteries that we did, the case of Bobby Dunbar? Do you remember that?
Absolutely remember.
Okay. Bobby. So one of the aspects of the Bobby Dunbar case was because it was a very famously publicized case in that area of the country. I believe it was Louisiana. And the police were under a lot of pressure to produce the missing boy who like went missing in the swamp or something like that, or out in the woods. And suddenly they came up with this kid and the mom's like, nah, it's not my kid. And that was one of the kind of interesting aspects of the kid. Well, let's talk about the case of young 9-year-old Walter Collins, who disappeared on March 10th, 1928. His mom, Kristen, was a phone operator. They lived in out in the Los Angeles area. Dad, Walter, was in the joint for various and sundry things. But Walter goes to the movies one day and is never seen again. This becomes a huge sensation in Los Angeles. Tons of pressure on the police department to solve this case. There was some initial speculation. Maybe his dad, apparently, one of his jobs in prison was to report on things that other prisoners did. He was basically a snitch. So-and-so over there, he didn't shut off his lights, but 5 minutes after he was supposed to. And, you know, so maybe he had done something to piss somebody off to get revenge on the dad. They went after the kid. Who knows? That was just one of the early speculations. So a matter of fact, this was such an interesting case. I don't know if you've ever. I believe you're familiar with the lovely actress Angelina Jolie.
Oh, yeah.
Angelina Jolie made a movie in 2009 called Changeling. It was a Clint Eastwood directed film that received very good. Angelina Jolie was nominated for an Academy Award for the performance. And it was about this story. So what happens is the boy disappears. Now the police are under tremendous pressure, as I'm saying, to come up with some kind of evidence. Well, all of a sudden, a couple months later in Illinois, a young boy comes forward and says, I'm Walter Collins. The mother, Christine, pays for the boy to be transported from Illinois to Los Angeles. And when she gets there, she gets to be a little suspicious, and she said, this is not my son. The reason for it was she said her son was a little bit shorter than this boy. And the other thing was, and this is like such a mom thing, was that the boy called her Ma, whereas she said her son only referred to her as mother. Oh. And that was like the thing that she really latched onto. So the police, this is great, by the way, the police like, you know, just let him stay with you and maybe it'll all come back to you later. Quality police work by the LA Police Department. Who would have thunk it? And so that they pushed the boy. So finally she goes and she has the kid go to the dentist and has the dentist take x-rays. She brings the x-rays back to the police department and says, yeah, see, here's his x-rays. Here are my sons. They're completely different.
Wow.
The police captain, let's see if I have a notation here. Yes, Captain, does this sound like a cop that's in a serialized novel? Captain J.J. Jones. tells her, you're a cruel and inhuman woman. And he has her institutionalized under the Baker Act. Okay. They put her in the nut house, excuse the expression, for claiming that this wasn't her son. Okay. So a couple weeks goes by. Finally, the young boy admits that his name is really Arthur Hutchins.
Wow.
He's a runaway and he only wanted to come to California to meet Tom Mix. Barry, this is a way back machine, but do you know who Tom Mix is?
Yeah, he was arguably the first big cowboy movie star of the 1920s.
Like before like John Wayne and Hopalong Cassidy, Roy Rogers. Tom Mix was the first big cowboy movie star. So this little boy, who it turns out was 11, said, I'm sorry. I didn't mean for you to get put in an institution, but I really wanted to meet Tom Mix. And so so they end up letting her go. Well, so now mom files the civil lawsuit and wins. And surprisingly, Barry, they never paid. I know that you'll find that completely shocking.
Yeah.
So there were some other boys, as the police began continuing their investigation, that had also disappeared. A couple of brothers, the Winslow brothers, as well as a young Mexican a boy. And the police suddenly began, as they're investigating this case, here's what happens. I almost jumped ahead of myself there. There was a young man named Gordon Northcutt. Okay. And Gordon Northcutt lived in a town of Wineville, California. That's in Riverside County. Now, Barry, I know you got to LA. You ever had the occasion to go to Riverside County?
You know what? A good friend of mine lives in Riverside. I've never been out to that area though.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So apparently at least in the '20s, it was a farming community. And so Gordon Northcutt, with help from his dad, had started a chicken farm.
Oh,
so, you know, chicken farmers. You know, how many times, you know who else was a famous chicken farmer besides this Gordon Northcutt, Bear?
Famous chicken farmers.
Yeah, Heinrich Himmler was a chicken farmer. I'm not even kidding.
How did you pull out Heinrich Himmler?
I watch Hogan's Heroes, okay?
All right.
So Gordon Northcutt is originally from Canada, goes up to Canada and asks his sister, hey, would you mind if my nephew Sanford, who's like 12 years old, comes down with me, visits me in California to help me get this chicken farm started and does a little, you know, stays a couple months, helps me get everything started. The sister, of course, says, sure, yeah, go ahead. You know, why would I think anything suspicious would be going on? So apparently when they get back down there, his nephew Sanford was coerced into helping him abduct and sexually assault young boys on the farm, apparently including his own nephew. Okay. So, so then the story goes, it's an unsolved mystery that's basically solved, but there's one key element that hasn't been solved, okay? The claim is that Gordon abducted Walter after he saw him shopping at the grocery store for his mom, where he worked part-time. I'm talking about Gordon.
Right.
And so Gordon, his mom, and the nephew all participated in the killing of Walter, reportedly because that way they figured no one could be charged with the murder if they all participated in it. So what happens is Sanford's sister comes to visit. The nephew confesses to his sister what's been going on. The sister, for some reason, doesn't go to the police in Wineville or in that area. She goes back to Canada. She reports it to the American consulate where they originally arrest Gordon. Do you know why? They arrest him for bringing his nephew into the country illegally. Yeah, that's what's known as finding a reason to hold him, I guess.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's kind of crazy. Let's see. The police then proceed to go to Gordon's farm and find human remains. The belief is that he may have killed as many as 30 young boys total. He is tried and convicted of murder of the two brothers that I mentioned, the Winslow brothers, and but not of Walter. Because, of course, I mentioned all three reportedly participated, so they couldn't be convicted. He's convicted on February 7th, 1929. He's hanged on October 2nd, 1930. So we recently celebrated the anniversary of his hanging, Barry. However, they never recovered the remains of Walter. All the remains that were discovered on the property, and they were never identified as being Walter. Christine Collins spent the rest of her life searching for her son, who she never really believed had been murdered. It's horrible being a parent, in that sort of situation. And the poor woman, God, I want to say she lived into the 1950s or 1960s, never found her son, never found his body, and continued to search for him. And that just had to be a haunting existence. So here's another interesting aspect. Apparently, the story, because this was such a cause celeb in the late 1920s, that the town of Wineville out in California became so identified with this horrible murder, multiple murders, they changed the name of the town, Barry.
Wow.
Are you familiar with the town of Mira Loma?
I've never been there. I've heard of it. I've never been there.
Mira Loma is the former Wineville there in Riverside County. So, yes. So the murder of Walter Collins, horrible, horrible case. The whole trying to slide in the second kid is this is your kid. Trust me.
So it's funny. Once you said Angelina Jolie and the Changeling, I saw about 30 minutes of this movie one night at like 2 a.m. as I was flipping around, and I went to bed and I completely forgot about it, but it was really riveting what I saw. Now, specifically, I am going to go check this movie out and even see if it's available so I can watch it tonight, because that's a hell of a story. That is an absolute nightmare that, you know, and could we do multiple episodes on the ineptitude of the LAPD? Like, is it right? We could probably just
not only that, through the years with the LAPD.
Right.
You know,
it never ends. It, like, you know, even to this day, it almost seems like it never ends. I can't for the life of me, you know, how the fuck can they not like get this shit straight? We've talked about this, though. We've talked about the LAPD in previous episodes and how they botch cases. And we're talking about, Jeff and I at the very best would be considered an amateur sleuth. And even that's probably giving us a little more there. But these are people that do this for a living. But they allegedly they miss these glaring, huge clues, which are right in front of them. The other aspect is maybe they're not missing it. Maybe they just decide, yeah, fuck it. We're just not going to acknowledge it for whatever reason.
Well, all I'll say is when it comes to police ineptitude, Barry, wait till I get to my third story, because there's a classic case of police bungling something that they shouldn't have bungled. So, Barry, now why don't you give us your second story?
Absolutely. Is this another Los Angeles story from you? Or?
No, as a matter of fact, it is not. It's a Florida story.
Oh, well, okay, there you go. That's all you had to say. I spoke to somebody today and I was telling them about our unsolved mysteries, and they go, so are any of these wrestling related? And I said, usually I have at least one wrestling story. Spoiler alert, I do not have a wrestling story. And then I said, I usually have a Florida story. Spoiler alert, I don't have a Florida story. But I did say that most of the cases are either Florida or California, which is pretty accurate. My next story, though, is Jeff, the I-70 killer. Now, have you ever driven I-70 before?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because as I was looking into the case that you said I'm doing, this is one of our stories, and I was looking, and one of the alleged murders by the I-70 killer, or who they suspected was the I-70 killer, took place in St. Charles, Missouri.
Yes.
St. Charles, Missouri is where my friends Jim and Mona Fishbein, where their daughter got married. So I was in St. Charles, Missouri like a year ago, maybe something like that. So, yeah.
That's interesting. What was the guy you did this to? The guy, the bully that, like, the entire town killed the bully? That was Missouri, right?
Yes, that was Missouri. Ken, I'm trying to think of his last
name. Ken something, right.
Yeah, but that was, like, small-town Missouri. That was, like, maybe, like, between Kansas City and St. Louis. That was, like, in the middle of... actually, another thing was more like a northern part of Missouri, but, like, geez, like, in the middle of bumfuck nowhere. Like,
Ken something, though, you're right.
If you look where this guy was killed... and that's the town that knew nothing or something like that. There've been, like, the Brian Dennehy movie about it. But like, if you go on a map and look on a map, I mean, there's nothing around this town, you know, it's like within like 100 miles. And like, you sit there and you ask yourself, why would people live here? You know, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's like a huge farming community and that's why people live there. But if it's not a huge farming community, I don't know why anyone would live there. So anyway, I-70 killer, Barry, why don't you tell us?
Is St. Charles on the St. Charles River as well?
Wow. I was told there'd be no geography.
We lied. Yeah. But
I know
I would,
I know it's outside of St. Louis, and it's I'm guessing I-70 is the major highway that my wife and I took to go to where the wedding was taking place.
Gotcha. Okay. So, anyways, the I-70 killer is an unidentified American serial killer who is known to have killed at a minimum 6 store clerks in the Midwest in the spring of 1992. His nickname came from the fact that most of these stores that the victims were working in were located just a couple of miles off of Interstate 70. His victims were usually young, petite, brunette women, but he is also suspected, Jeff, of shooting 3 more store clerks in Texas during 93 and 94, one of whom survived. The killing spree, Jeff, began on April 8th, 1992, with the murder of a 26-year-old Payless shoe source manager, Robin Foldauer. You ever been in a Payless shoe?
I have purchased your quality footwear at a Payless, where you get more for less. A casual Dockers type of footwear.
Gotcha. So somebody gave me great advice about 35, 40 years ago when I was a young waiter in the restaurant.
Don't shop at Payless. Is that what you?
Well, yes, in a nice way. They said you can go to Payless and you can pay $30 for a pair of shoes and do that every 2 or 3 months, or you can invest in a $100 pair of shoes and have those for a year or longer.
Yes, and let me say that advice is accurate. Yes, it's absolutely accurate.
It's right. That's like the best of all the advice anyone has ever given me. That may be the most spot on advice. I was like, that's fucking genius. And my man, they were 100% right. So in any case, Robin Foldauer, who I'm assuming based off of what he likes, she was a young petite brunette, which I like young petite brunettes. I mean, we all do. She was murdered.
Wait a minute now. My wife's a redhead, so I will not be part of that.
Well, Jeff, wait till my next story about redheads. But she was killed. This was in Indianapolis. She was alone in the store when she was shot, having been murdered somewhere between 1:30 and 2 o'clock p.m. So they were able to narrow it down. The next 2 murders occurred on April 11th at a bridal shop in Wichita. The victims were 23-year-old Patricia Smith and the store's owner, 32-year-old Patricia Maggers. So you've got an owner and an employee, both with the same first name. This was the only case involving multiple victims. Investigators also believed the killer was under the impression that there was only one woman in the store. The women had stayed past the normal closing time of 6 p.m. to allow a male customer to pick up a cummerbund. I don't know why that's important to this case. Sometime after 6 p.m., the women allowed the killer into the store, thinking he was the customer they were waiting for. There's my answer. After the women were murdered, the actual customer arrived to pick up the cummerbund and came face to face with the I-70 killer. The killer, however, let the man go, who immediately notified police. He would later provide details for a composite sketch. So 2 weeks later, April 27th, Michael McCown, 40, was killed in his mother Sylvia's ceramic store in Terre Haute, Indiana. Now, Jeff, you've got 2 questions here that you're asking. One is, I thought he liked small, petite, brunette women. That's the first question. Well, McCown was the only man killed during the spree, and it's believed by the investigators that the killer chose the store because the store's solo woman's name, Sylvia Ceramics, seemed to make it a good target. However, Michael McCown wore a ponytail and was shot from behind, so he was kneeling to stock the shelves. There he was. The killer thought he was a woman. He's down on his knees. His back is turned. He shot him in the back of the head. The other interesting aspect of this, there was no robberies taking place. There was nothing of a sexual nature. These were just strictly random murders, which is very odd. Moving on, May 4th, 24-year-old Nancy Kitzmiller was killed while working alone at Boot Village, a footwear shop in St. Charles, Missouri. This would be the second footwear store, by the way. She opened up the shop at noon, was found dead at 2:30 p.m. The final confirmed murder occurred May 7th in Raytown, Missouri. Now, is Raytown near St. Charles or?
I don't know, but that's a great name for a town.
Raytown.
Where you live? I live in Raytown.
I live in Jefftown.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. The victim was...
There is no Berrytown, as far as I know, though.
Not that you ever want to go to be honest with you. Right. The victim was 37-year-old Sarah Blessing, who was working in her gift shop, Store of Many Colors. So the other thing I want to bring up, these were all, except for Payless, these were all very small mom-and-pop specialty stores with horrible names.
Well, you know where that name comes from, Store of Many Colors. Dolly Parton song, Code of Many Colors.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Throwing out the country music knowledge. There.
Hey, we'll take it. That's great.
Woo! Okay, go ahead.
The murder occurred during the day, and the owner of the video store next to her Blessing shop saw the killer enter the shop, heard a loud pop, and then saw the killer leave. He discovered the body after checking to see what had just taken place. A clerk at a nearby grocery store also saw the suspect. He was climbing a hill towards I-70. No idea why he's climbing a hill. However,
maybe to get to a vehicle.
Well, exactly. Well, yeah, I thought you were going to say to get to the top of the hill, like a smart ass, right? But you're right.
Smart ass? Really? Provided. Is that what you think of me?
Instead, you provided a valuable piece of information. I'm really disappointed in you right now. So, investigators believe the I-70 killer may be responsible for two murders in 93 and then an attempted murder in 94, all three of which took place in Texas. The two murder victims were 51-year-old Mary Ann Glasscock, who was killed on September 25th, 1993 in Fort Worth.
Don't.
I know. I'm holding back. You know I am. She was killed at the Emporium Antique Store, and 22-year-old Amy Vess, who was shot to death in a dance apparel store in Arlington on November the 1st. However, the surviving victim was Vicky Webb, 35, who was shot on January 15th, 1994 in Houston at the Alternatives gift shop. Now, is that a country song, Jeff? Is that
that's another kind of gift store, I'm guessing. Alternatives.
The Alternatives, absolutely. The Alternatives gift shop. She briefly talked to the shooter before he shot her in the back of the head. The bullet did not penetrate into Webb's head due to a large vertebrae being hit. I don't know. I don't know what that means. Okay. So I guess he was shooting her in the neck.
The
vertebrae.
It's a misfire. It's a misfire. He meant to go for the top of her skull and hit the back of her neck instead. Who knows?
For all of our Jewish listeners too, it's not a mitzvah. It was a misfire that Jeff said. So the shooter attempted to shoot her again, realizing he had fucked up, but his gun misfired.
Yes. Then there was an actual misfire.
There's a real misfire. And he left Webb to be dead. She wasn't. So the modus operandi, the M.O.
Yeah, boy.
Neely Shockett doesn't really listen to the show. And if he does, it's 6 months later. But I know he doesn't miss an episode of Law and Order. But Law and Order, it's a stellar show. So the M.O. of the Texas killer, really similar to the I-70 killer. They both used 22 caliber firearms. However, a ballistics test determined that the gun used in the Texas murders was not the same as the one used in the I-70 killings. So investigators never confirmed that they were tied. There is just a lot of circumstantial evidence. However, the murders were linked after a St. Charles detective, there we are, suspected the connection. All of the murders, again, with a 22 caliber firearm. All of the victims were usually petite young women with long, dark hair. And aside from the Wichita murders, all the victims were alone, all shot in the back of the head. None of the scenes had any signs of a sexual assault and robbery, as we talked about, appeared to be some sort of secondary motive because these stores didn't have a lot of money, and there was no merchandise missing, nothing like that. These murders also, Jeff, took place at slow times of the day, when the stores were deserted after lunch, closing time, and they were all also in strip malls right near I-70. So based off of witness descriptions, investigators were able to produce two composite sketches of the killer and a physical description of the suspect. The I-70 killer was described as being a white man in his 20s or 30s, about 5'7 to 5'9, tall, thin, and having lazy eyelids and sandy blonde or reddish hair. If he is still alive, he would be in his 50s at this point. Police have not publicly identified any suspects, and the case has been classified as a cold case. But, and Jeff, this is a big juicy but right here.
There's nothing quite like a big juicy but I digress.
It makes the show so much more interesting. In 2018, DNA from the body of Neil Falls, a suspected serial killer killed by a sex worker named Heather Saul in Charleston, West Virginia, was tested for possible involvement. Falls lived in Kansas at the time and resembles the identity of the I-70 killer. But so far, no conclusive proof has been found as to his responsibility for any of these murders. Now, the first thing that pops into my head when I read this is somebody who wants to kill. This is not a sexual thing unless they're getting off on it, but they're not touching these women and the one guy at all. They're strictly going in to kill. Robbery is not the true motive because, A, they're really not taking anything. And these stores, you know, the colors of the window, whatever the fuck the store was called, there's not going to be a lot of money in the till for that one. So murder is. So you're looking for somebody who is attracted to murder, per se, as opposed to anything else. The second is the proximity of I-70. Unless you're looking for somebody who is trying to draw a profile on themselves. You know, David Berkowitz was known for trying to create a persona for himself. Unless this person is doing it, there is a reason they are close to I-70, which makes me think, as we all know, possibly a trucker, possibly somebody who was traveling for a living, something like that. You know, we talked about Tank Morgan in one of our episodes, which we had a lot of fun with. And, you know, there was a theory out there that Tank was a hired killer, an assassin of sorts, because he moved around a lot. And in the wrestling territory days, that's all you did. You moved around a lot. So this makes me wonder if this guy's on a major highway, and I-70, Jeff, is a major fucking highway. What's his connection to it otherwise? Was he traveling these roads, Jeff? You tell me.
Well, I think the trucker theory is a pretty valid one. Or, you know, you don't really see it, but like a traveling salesman kind of somebody that travels for a living, obviously. But the thing that strikes me is, you know, obviously if, with the one exception of the guy with the ponytail, if these are women in a store at hours where it's not busy and they're there by themselves, that means the guy had to have watched them. You know, he had to know that, you know, in the, you know, the store of many colors or whatever the hell it was called, that, you know, oh, this particular time of day, there's not gonna be anybody in there with her. So if I go in there, she's not gonna have, you know, 30 customers in there that I'm gonna have to deal with. So he had to do some sort of initial investigation before he moved in for the kill, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with that too. It's one thing to know, look, we all know that, you know,
what haven't you said today, by the way?
Jeff, you would be 100% correct.
Check.
Right. And we know, you know, that, there are going to be busy and slower times in businesses, restaurants. You never go to a restaurant. And if you're doing business with a restaurant between the hours of say 11:30 and 2 o'clock, because it's the lunch rush. So the prevailing theory here was, you know, obviously you go to a store at the end of the day as they're closing. But I'm going to go with what you said, because he would have had to do some sort of recon in some sort of surveillance work to know that, okay, if I go here at 1:30, we'll take Payless between 1:30 and 2, there's never been anybody in the store. So I would agree that he was casing these joints out, which makes you wonder, and again, you know, investigators are going to be, except for lesser LAPD, investigators are going to be really on the ball a lot more than probably you and I could be because of their training. But with that being said, I guess in those days there wasn't security cams, and there was, you know, in early 90s, certainly now you can't walk down a street without fucking 100 cameras on you. But back in those days, I think it was a completely different scenario. So I am going to go with what you said. And the traveling salesman thing is interesting also. It had to be somebody who was traveling. And whether it was a trucker, a traveling salesman, and what I like about that is you don't see traveling salesmen any longer. That's almost something that is completely just gone by the wayside with the internet in the last 25, 30 years. So I really like that aspect as well. Anybody that was traveling that route frequently is somebody who would have to be looked at, but I'm assuming that's probably a lot of people. But really interesting, there have been, and this is, I guess, an addendum to it, there have been nothing that is copycat to this since these killings took place in 1994, which would have been the last. It was 92 to, if Texas is part of it, 94. So you're 26 years removed at this point.
Well, let me ask you, the guy that was killed by the prostitute, what year did he die?
That I don't know. That did not pop up in my articles. Yeah.
You know, if it was like, you know, late 90s, well, you know, it might have a pretty much obvious conclusion there. Okay, my third and final story, Barry. Oh, we go back to police ineptitude. And we don't want to make this a theme of these shows. But there's sometimes when you just sit there and you go, really? Really? So, Barry, I'm going to discuss the case of, pronounce this correctly, Althea Ponzel Lindsley. Okay. Now, Althea was a woman who lived in St. Augustine, Florida.
Oh.
And she was known as, in her past, an American model, a Broadway dancer, political activist, and a television personality on the show Winner Take All. Barry, you remember seeing the show Winner Take All?
Yeah, wait, what years was that?
Obviously I would guess it was in the late 60s, early 70s.
Okay, yeah.
So she at one time was engaged to Joseph Kennedy Jr.
Ooh.
Did you ever see the movie with Peter Strauss about Joe Kennedy Jr.?
I think Peter Strauss, where there's a name I haven't heard in years. Yeah.
Really interesting.
It was on
story.
ABC. Was on ABC.
He was the son that Joe Kennedy Sr. basically was planning on making the guy that was going to run for the Senate and then the president one day. And then when he was killed in an incident during World War II. They were carrying, either some bombs or some sort of explosives. He was the pilot and his plane blew up. And, that's the way he was killed. And then that basically took JFK, John F. Kennedy, and slid him into that slot where dad began making the push for the Senate and later the presidency and all that. So she had been engaged to Joe Kennedy before his death. I believe she was married a couple times. She was sort of almost famous for being famous, if you will. She was like a St. Augustine version of the Kardashians. And she, at the time of her death, had been married for a short time to former St. Augustine mayor James Lindsley, who is a real estate guy. They lived in separate houses, which sort of odd that you're married 6 months and you live in a separate house. But the story was that she wanted to stay in her house because she was planning on selling. They both did like real estate. And so she was trying to get her house sold, hadn't been able to sell the house. So she also had been involved in a neighborhood feud with a gentleman named Alan Stanford Jr. She was one of these people who was very active in the pet rescue and animal rights and stuff like that. And which, of course, we hear in Breaking Cape Bay with Badger and Barry, very big pet people, especially dogs, cats, not so much, but dogs definitely. And she was like a person that would keep multiple dogs in her house. Well, the dogs, much like dogs will do, began barking, and this guy Alan Stanford was among a couple neighbors that would sort of kind of bitch, hey, lady, keep your dogs quiet. Yeah. So because of this, he apparently was the county manager for St. John's County, which is St. Augustine. And she began going to county meetings, city meetings, questioning his credentials as to whether or not he was the right man for the job. It just essentially kind of being a pain in the neck to the guy. Okay. Well, on January 23rd, 1974, in front of her house, she's attacked and killed by a man. Here we go, Barry, with a machete.
Oh.
The man was wearing a white dress shirt and black pants. He struck Athalia so hard that her head was almost decapitated. She was outside. By the way, this is a great part of the story, with no disrespect to the dead. As I said, she was a huge pet activist. She had a pet blue jay that apparently she had found it, somehow, I don't know, broken wing, broken leg, whatever. She was trying to nurse it back to health. So she kept it in a bird cage. Okay. She was outside taking the blue jay for a walk. Never heard of that one before.
So never heard of that.
The only thing missing from the crime scene in her house was the blue jay. So, you know, maybe there was somebody that was a violently anti-blue jay. I don't know. Somebody that wasn't a Toronto fan. So, you know. Anyway, as the attack is happening, an 18-year-old neighbor whose name is Locke McCormick heard the sounds of commotion, went outside to look. He allegedly then shouted to his mom in the house, "Mr. Stanford is hitting Mrs. Ponsel," which is Lindsley's maiden name. Okay. So then they go over there. They see what's happening, and she's laying there, you know, bloody and dead. The police come to the scene, and, oh, Barry, here's where we get to the police, dare I say, ineptitude. As you might imagine from a machete attack, there's a large quantity of blood on the scene. One of the police officers tells someone on the scene, "Get a hose and wash the blood off the sidewalk in the grass." No, no, we certainly don't want to keep any DNA-related evidence, do we? Let's wash the area down with a hose.
Wow.
Wow. Yes, that's
wow.
That's not good. So now all the story comes in of the conflict between Stanford and Mrs. Lindsley, and Stanford is arrested. The community, because he's apparently an active churchgoer, that kind of thing, and his church and the local community raises $20,000 for his bond and $250,000 for his legal defense. They must have really believed this guy was not guilty, okay? So during the time between his arrest and his trial, a local mechanic is out, and he's by the local dump because, you know, why wouldn't you go to the local dump just to hang out?
Oh, yeah.
And see, and we'd find things. That's something I often do on the weekends. He finds a box, and the box inside the – what do you suppose is inside the box, Bear?
What's inside the box? I don't know.
A bloody white shirt and black trousers.
Wow.
First time we ever used the word trousers on this show.
Yeah.
Along with a watch that Stanford had claimed had been stolen. The shirt, this is an interesting aspect, it has Stanford's monogram on it. Now, there's a belief, supposition, guesswork, that the watch and the shirt were in fact taken from Stanford's home as the police were doing the casing of Stanford's home. As they're going in, investigating, trying to find clues, maybe they lifted one of his shirts, lifted the watch, kind of planted it for this mechanic who may or may not have been cahoots with the police. I guess I can say this because everyone involved in this case, I believe, is dead by now. And maybe left it there. Oh, hey, look what I found. And all of a sudden, the police are building the case against this guy, Stanford. Because, again, like some of the other cases we mentioned, Barry, lots of local publicity and lots of demand for the police to make an arrest and get a conviction on this case. Okay, because this woman was very well known in the area. She was, dare I say, she was also well known for being quite the the word they call him now is a bitch. They wouldn't have used that word back then, but she was somebody that was tough to deal with. And maybe whether that was because she had money or what, or used to getting her way. But she did not like to be told no. You know, she was somebody who she was a get things done kind of gal. And that rubbed some people the wrong way. OK. And so anyway. The trial is taking place. Stanford's acquitted after only 2.5 hours of deliberation on a murder case, Barry. Now, let me just tell you, it's a longtime employee of the court system. I can tell you 2.5 hours, that's what you get like on a DUI case, okay? Right. On a murder case, you're usually talking, a good couple of days, if not a week's worth of deliberation, especially a case like this, because there's probably so much evidence to go over. Now, the belief was that the jurors in the case basically ordered in lunch, picked a foreman and said, yeah, this guy's not guilty. The police captain, chief of police, whatever, of course, is outraged, says, you know, I believe he did it. You know, we were the ones that gathered the evidence, and I think he did it. So, but wait, there's more, Barry. Oh, a little more.
What?
Case. Yes, I like to leave you hanging, my friend.
Wow.
A friend of the victim's named Frances Beamans went out for a walk one night and is discovered dead. Her head was crushed by a cement block. Reportedly, she had made it known in public that she was working on a book about her friend's murder. and that she had evidence that no one else knew about. Her murder as well, never solved. So let's discuss some theories. Now, Stanford, of course, is the real obvious, you know, person.
Right.
You know, of course, once they acquit him, they can't, you know, charge him again for the murder because there are witnesses.
Double jeopardy, Jeff.
Exactly. Ooh, very good. Which was also right. Not a bad movie with, you know, who's in that? Ashley Judd and Morgan Freeman, I think. Anyway. Witnesses had placed Stanford at his office at the time of the death. Now, her husband, the mayor, former mayor of St. Augustine, she had told her friends that her new husband was, quote, a big liar. And, you know, that there were some problems right from the get-go. The husband, a man of means, a man who had lots of money to perhaps make things happen, I'm just going to say, Barry. Both of the deaths feature, I'm talking about Miss Lindsley and Miss Bemis, there was lots of rage and lots of anger in the death. These were, you know, the cases you talked about, the I-70 cases, were very quick, deliberate, boom, and it's over. You know, whereas you discussed earlier, you know, when you kill with a knife or with a machete,
yes,
that perhaps there's some rage and anger involved. I'm just going to hazard a quick guess. So the mechanic. His name was Dewey Lee, the guy that discovered the evidence at the dump. Was he involved somehow with the planting of the evidence? Maybe Dewey had something to do with the death of Mrs. Lindsley. By the way, in the perfectly reasonable about this, when Mrs. Bemis was killed, the lady that supposedly knew stuff about the case, Stanford out on bail. So he was out of custody, so you can't use that. So, Barry, this was a very huge case in St. Augustine. You had I'm going to call her a socialite, you know, a lady of means who's killed in a very violent manner, like in the daylight. This was not something that happened in the middle of the night, you know. Now, Mrs. Bemis was killed during a nightly walk, so it was, you know, it was in the night, But Mrs. Lindsley was killed during the day with a machete in front of her house. And, you know, and the only thing missing is that pet blue jay. That blue jay was never seen again.
Yeah, somebody wanted her dead. When you go, as you said, when you go after somebody with a machete, it's one of two things or both. It's A, you're either mentally deranged or you're really fucking angry. Like, you're really pissed off. And you said she was a bitch. I think bitch was okay. In that era, I think now there's a lot more colorful vernacular that we could talk about. See you next Tuesday.
No, but we're not going to use that word.
We won't say that word, but I think bitch is acceptable. But this is an interesting. Have you ever been to St. Augustine, Jeff?
Of course. We went to.
I would think you have, right?
When last I was up visiting my parents, we actually did lunch on the St. John's River in St. Augustine.
It's not far from Jacksonville, right?
No, it's like about from where my parents live. It's about a 20-mile drive. You know,
gotcha. I believe it's also the oldest city in the U.S. Yes, if I'm correct.
Indeed, my wife and I a few years ago vacationed at a friend's house right down by the coastline. Very active bar and restaurant area where the big fort is there. That like you know. And by the way, you go into that fort. And you sit there and think, wait a minute, people lived in here? Wow. And, you know, but it's a very touristy town now, but maybe not so much in 1972.
Yeah, exactly, too. And that's interesting. In 1974, there was the occasional CWF show taking place there as well. Was not a regular stop.
Was Tank Morgan in town? In 1974?
That's where I was going to go, Jeff. I was somehow going to tie in Tank Morgan.
Add a wrestling component to this show.
Yes, we are. So, Jeff, I'll be back. I'm going to do a little research. Yes. I think Tank Morgan was working in Florida in 74, and this woman was killed mysteriously in St. Augustine. You do the math on that one.
Yeah,
okay. We're tying up all the loose ends right here. That's a great story, though.
So what is your third and final story? And, Barry, I know that a word is going to be used that you are not familiar with, and that word is Bible.
It is Bible, and the second word is going to be brevity, because I know we're we're approaching at least 90 minutes, and this next story could take me 6 hours. So I got to kind of get through this. But this one is this one actually has two names, Jeff. One is the Bible Belt Strangler, also known as the Redhead Murders, such as when I referenced redheads, when you referenced it.
Yes.
It refers to a series of unsolved homicides of redheaded females between October 1978 and the year 1992, committed by what is believed a male serial killer. It is thought that there are somewhere a total of 6 to 11 victims. Of the presumed victims, only 4 have been identified. This is as of 2 years ago. The murders occurred in Tennessee, Arkansas, Kentucky, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, where I currently reside, and Mississippi. I'm not sure that Pennsylvania is in the Bible Belt, but maybe it is. We'll see about that one, too. The victims, many remaining unidentified for years, were usually women with reddish hair, whose bodies were abandoned along major highways in the U.S. Officials believe that the women were likely hitchhiking or may have engaged in prostitution. And we're going to bring that fact up in just a little bit as well, Jeff, because we like bringing up the facts of prostitution. So there were
I'll bow to your better knowledge on that, sir. But
well, anyway. Allegedly. Right. Allegedly.
Of course.
I've got to be brief to some because there is a lot that's wrapped around this one, but the first body occurred September 16th, 1984. 28-year-old Lisa Nichols found along Interstate 40 in West Memphis, Arkansas. West Memphis, Arkansas, Jeff, known for something that we've discussed. She was wearing only a sweater. She was a resident, however, of West Virginia. Authorities were not able to identify and contact her family members for some time because Nichols was estranged from them. She was not identified until about a year later in 1985 after she had been strangled by a couple from Florida who had allowed her to stay with them for a period of time. She was ID'd through her fingerprints. January 1st, 1985, the body of Tina Farmer was found near Jellicoe, Tennessee, down an embankment off the southbound side of Interstate 75. Tina Farmer's a name we're going to revisit, and there's a reason for it, and we'll get to that in a couple minutes. The cause of death, again, Jeff, strangulation. She had been wrapped in a blanket, which was later found to have seminal fluid on it. The young woman had various...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We all have those blankets that have seminal fluid on it. So,
again, I'll bow to your better knowledge on that, sir.
Yeah. The young woman had various scars, including a burn mark on one arm, and was 10 to 12 weeks pregnant when she died. She had a partial upper denture holding in 2 false teeth. It took over 33 years before the Shelby County Sheriff's Office announced that the victim had been identified through fingerprints as Tina Farmer of Indiana. So this was interesting too. Tina was 21 or 22 at the time of her death. She was last seen in Indianapolis, accompanied by a trucker said to be headed to Kentucky. Tina had one daughter prior to disappearing in 84. She was reported missing by her family at the time. But authorities, for whatever reason, Jeff, did not enter her into a national database. Was this ineptitude? Apparently not. I actually did research on this one. The state did not have a law that was common to many other states requiring law enforcement to enter her into the database. So why there wasn't a law, I have no idea. But however, April the 3rd, so just to be, 3 months later, 1985, the skeletonized partial remains of a young girl were discovered about 200 yards off Big Wheel Gap Road, which, Jeff, is only 4 miles southwest of Jellicoe, Tennessee. She was discovered near a strip mine. She was believed to have been dead between 1 and 4 years, and her age was estimated anywhere between 9 and 15 years old. This did throw investigators as most of the victims were older, in their 20s. However, apparently this young lady looked older, which would have been the thought process here. Her skull was complete enough to permit a facial reconstruction attempt, but a lot went down with this. So March 31st, the skeletonized body of a red-haired female was found in Pleasant View, Cheatham County, Tennessee. You ever been to Cheatham County, Tennessee, Jeff?
I have not had the pleasure, I'm sure, of being to Cheatham County.
Gotcha. She was believed to have been dead anywhere between 3 and 5 months. So this is one of those side cases. They can't pinpoint it and say that this is part of the Bible Belt redhead killings. However, the detectives believe that her case is linked. She had red hair. Her remains were found at the side of Interstate 24. All the signs add up. So there were several other cases that they couldn't necessarily pinpoint. One they were able to. April the 1st, 1985, the body of a woman was found in a large white refrigerator in Gray, Knox County, Kentucky, alongside Route 25. Her death? Suffocation. The victim had been dead for several days and was completely nude, except she was wearing two pairs of socks. It doesn't say why she was wearing two pairs of socks, but they were different. One was striped, one was not. And she had on two distinctive necklace pendants. One was a heart, one was a gold eagle. The refrigerator had a decal of the word Superwoman on the front. Distinguishing features of the body included a number of moles and a scar and other marks on her abdomen, indicating that she had borne a child. Her hair was red and nearly a foot long, which fit the pattern. Moving on. October the 1st, 2018, the sheriff's department finally is able to positively identify this woman after 33 years. Her name was Espy Regina Black Pilgrim. I didn't make that up either, Jeff.
Okay.
Regina Black Pilgrim of Western North Carolina. A DNA match was made between her and her grown daughter, who said her mother had disappeared when the girl was 6 weeks old. Pilgrim also had four older children. So they were correct with the scar on the abdomen. She had five kids all together. So let's look at some multiple. There were multiple suspected victims. First off, it is believed that most of the victims remain unidentified due to being estranged or not close to existing family members. They also weren't native to the states in which they were found. So we just talked about one lady, you know, West Virginia, she's found in another state. This was happening. So after this was happened, the states PA, Tennessee, Arkansas, Mississippi requested the FBI assisting that some of these were that they join in and try to help out. There were inconsistencies among some of the victims and characteristics, as some were found with or without clothing, and some had had a sexual encounter before their murders. However, about trying to see the year on this, and there was no within the last 5 to 6 years, the theory came out that the Bible Belt Strangler is a white male born between 1936 and 1962, which would have made him anywhere between 23 and 49 in 1985. Most likely, Jeff, a commercial trucker frequenting Interstate 40. His work was likely based in or around the city of Knoxville, Tennessee. Why is that why is that important, Jeff? Because the first suspect was a 32-year-old trucker in Pennsylvania who was questioned after kidnapping and raping a young woman in the state of Indiana. She managed to escape and actually escaped the killer. The suspect was then dismissed from the investigation after being questioned by Tennessee police, as apparently he had an airtight alibi. But the leading suspect emerged in 1985 when 37-year-old trucker Jerry Leon Johns attacked and attempted to strangle a woman with reddish hair that he had picked up in Knox County just 2 months after Farmer's disappearance and death. He bound and strangled the woman, left her laying near a highway, presuming she was dead. He was later dismissed in the redheaded murders case, but was convicted of the woman's kidnapping in 1987. Now, in a little fact that will completely boggle your mind here, despite his exclusion from the cases of being the murderer of the Bible Belt killer, it was announced that DNA from Johns was matched to the body of Tina Farmer in 2016.
I hate when that happens.
Of course, at this stage, there's nothing we can do because this man died in prison in 2015 at the age of 67. So not only was his DNA found on one of the victims, again, some 30 years later, 31 years later, he was dead at this point. Johns was a trucker, and guess where he lived? Knoxville, Tennessee, my friend.
Oh, my.
So we're going with the fact that we believe that Jerry Leon Johns was the Bible Belt Strangler.
Well, when you say we, Barry.
we is the royal we, Jeff.
Oh, okay.
As in the royal we.
Don't want the Johns family to think that I have come up with this supposition.
Right.
My guest this week, Barry Rose, not my co-host this week, just strictly a guest, has come up with this theory on his own. Please continue, Barry.
But that's where we are. So unfortunately, I believe that they are still trying to tie in more cases to this because apparently there were more. There were some that did not have red hair, and that's what made them think, because the predominating factor was, look, it was the red hair and the strangulation, but they did find darker haired females who had been strangled, and they are trying to tie those cases. As of today, they have not linked them all together, but really interesting. Unfortunately, with this gentleman being dead, I don't know how much farther they're going to get. I think with DNA evidence, though, perhaps they can pull DNA off of some of the other bodies. They can do more research. But, you know, will they? That I don't know.
So, OK, well, you know, lots of stuff to think about. You know, as you're telling the story, Barry, I find myself thinking that what was the name? I'm trying to search for it right now. Here it is. 1997 Kurt Russell Breakdown. Do you remember that movie? Oh.
What a frightening Kurt Russell. Kathleen Quinlan played his wife.
And the great J.T. Walsh.
That's who it is. My God, is he J.T. Walsh? But who was the actual trucker? Remember how scary that guy was?
No, that was J.T. Walsh. He was the.
Oh, that is OK.
And it was also M.C. Gainey.
That's what I'm thinking of. No, it's yes, M.C. Gainey.
He was in the Nicolas Cage, the Con Air. He was the pilot.
That's right.
In Con Air. Yeah. So
sweet mustache he's got too.
Yeah, exactly. The reason I bring up a breakdown is because, and I don't want to disparage an entire industry, okay? Let's just say that the cross-country trucking industry possibly has some rather sketchy individuals involved with it. Certainly not everybody. There are some quality family men and individuals in that industry, but it's an industry that strikes me as one that possibly could attract people with, you know, not such good things in mind. As we recall the story about the indigenous women up in British Columbia, that the suspect was believed to be a long distance trucker. And here we've got a couple stories that you've come up with that involve people in the long distance trucking industry. And you know, it's scary to think that way, that these, you know, people can go from town to town. And, you know, the other thing to consider, and we've talked about this in another case, and God, for whatever reason, I can't remember which one it was now. The fact that you get these, I know what it was. It's this stinking Zodiac case where that's communities within a state that didn't want to work together. When you have different states that each have their own case that don't want to give up their evidence to a different, you know, much less a different jurisdiction, a different state's jurisdiction, that's, you know, if you don't get the FBI involved in cases like this, you have almost no chance of getting that stuff, resolved, because there's just too much complication with all the different jurisdictions and states and agencies involved. And it's real hard to get that stuff taken care of. So anyway, all right, Bear, I think we got another Unsolved Mysteries under our belts. We want to thank all of you for listening. Let us know if you enjoy these kind of things. And who knows, maybe we'll eventually get to Unsolved Mysteries number 7 or 8, whichever one it is, because I've got that one, Barry, from another country that I mentioned to you that has some pretty twisted elements to it. And again, police ineptitude.
You're ready to go, Jeff. You're ready to go right now.
Should the title of this episode be Sexual Free Agent or Police Ineptitude? Which one do you like better?
Police ineptitude is probably more accurate, but Sexual Free Agent is what's going to take on a life
that's
of its own.
That's going to bring in the numbers, you know, ratings and stuff. Hey, you know, I got one last thing to bring up, Barry. I'm going to call back last weekend's or last week's show when we discussed our picks for the top guitarist of all time. Now, Barry, maybe you noticed on our board, there's been quite a bit of discussion, and I figured it out. You know, movies, television, sports, murders. No, what brings more people to the table than anything is musical opinions, whether it's what is new wave, what isn't new wave, who are the top five guitarists of all times. And I'll tell all of you that posted your personal links who came up with these obscure motherfuckers. You know, I'm sorry that I didn't include Clubfoot Walker. I'm making that name up.
Clubfoot Walker.
You know, I just made that name up there. But, you know,
these gold
obscure guitarists, you know, and they're like, I can't believe you didn't mention this guy. He's got to be on the left. Like, I never even fucking heard of this guy. You know, oh, I'm sorry that I included Clapton and Hendrix and Van Halen and not Clubfoot fucking Walker.
So, Clubfoot, sexual free agent, Clubfoot fucking Walker.
Clubfoot Walker, my friend, he did not let his disability keep him down. All right, on behalf of Clubfoot Walker and sexual free agent Krista Helm, I will say that our producer is a great Lou Kippelman. On behalf of our special guest this week, Barry Rose.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you very much.
Maybe you can come back next week.
love to join you again sometime. That'd be great.
Oh, they call me the Booker. I'll talk to you next week, folks. Clubfoot fucking Walker.